From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Carlos,
Berkeley,
Potrero Hill,
Bernal Heights,
Sharp Park.
Coming up, your reactions to racial injustice in America.
I want to say to all the people who are finding themselves steeped in despair, it is okay if you do not want to go out and fight. It is okay if you don't want to turn to social media. Even the greatest soldiers have to rest after war.
Then, Bay Area hip-hop artists use culture to counter harmful stereotypes.
It's so important to make sure that we control the message of who we are. And if we don't, then we get shot by police at a higher rate.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
There's actually dog paws down there, too. So when we have our dog running, we make her touch those dog paws.
Stories of striving, today on Cross Currents. This week, the U.S. Department of Justice released a 163-page report detailing the systemic ways in which the Baltimore Police Department implements harmful racial bias in its policing practices. The report coincides with the 2-year anniversary of the fatal police shooting of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson, Missouri, and throughout the summer, national conversations around police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement have intensified. Today, we conclude a week-long series made in collaboration with the East Bay Express, who asked readers to write about their reactions to police violence. We'll hear from three local people who shared their thoughts.
My name's Nicole Lovett, and I live in Oakland.
My name is Josiah DiCarlo. I live in Berkeley, California.
My name is Tamisha Danielle Price, native of Oakland, California.
Do you believe there is life aside from this earth? My roommate TT poses this question as we finish eating dinner. She, a beautiful black woman, me, a gay Hispanic male. Two humans who couldn't be more different. We are sharing a bottle of wine, coming to terms with the destruction that has been invested into our respective communities.
Growing up in Oakland, I've been aware of gun violence from a young age. I detached myself from the disturbing feeling it brought. Then my brother's friends started dying. My friends' friends started dying. I was suddenly aware that I was not safe. I am not safe as a person living in Oakland, not as a black person, not as a queer person, not around police.
Dear America, perhaps you may have forgotten my permission to exist within the grips of your unfavorable realm of democracy that has dissolved into ashes of black bodies beaming from caskets, engraved in the soil in which we were once told to stand proudly on.
I can't describe to you the feeling that came onto me upon realizing that, for my entire life, I've never been safe. Maybe I already knew. I think I did. But for the first time, I've been forced to look at the facts straight in the eye. All of that truth, it stared at me deep and said, "I've got you." And it's been hard for me to breathe ever since.
She looks at me with eyes that are wise beyond her years. She is a modern woman, paving her way in a world that offers her neglect, racism, and opportunities that come with a price to lose your sanity. I, a gay male, resonate with this oppression because we've been marginalized in a contemporary society that preaches tolerance but crushes our hopes with unimaginable violence.
Yesterday, I wept for Tamir Rice and toy guns that bothered you when the mere sight of black adolescents made you self-destruct and being birthed from my mother's womb was the tipping point for black lives to matter. We watched as you pumped bullets into bodies that cried out like whispers gone mad, gasping for last breaths, heartbeats erupting, hearing communities weep while hovering over mothers that cry for futures that will forever remain skewed. No longer can we sit idle and be the docile creatures you expect us to be, because we are more.
I think there is life outside this earth, she tells me, as she scrolls through her Facebook. The humans here are at the bottom, she pauses, of the food chain.
I want to say to all the people who are finding themselves steeped in despair, it is okay if you do not want to go out and fight. It is okay if you don't want to turn to social media. Even the greatest soldiers have to rest after war.
We can't sanitize any of the horrors of the last 100 years. We can't escape into an alternate universe and leave this world behind. At least not yet. But we can be there for one another. Help each other get through these tumultuous times.
My skin should never cause you to forget that before I'm black, I'm human. And so I ask of you today to see me as more, because we have always been and will forever be. Sincerely, a black culture in mourning.
Those were the voices of Tamisha Danielle Price, Josiah DiCarlo, and Nicole Lovett, three Bay Area residents who wrote into the East Bay Express in response to police violence against people of color. The audio versions were produced by KALW's Lucy King and Justine Lee. To hear all the audio essays from our week-long series, Bay Area Voices on Racial Injustice, head to our website, kalw.org, and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Our next story is also a collaboration, this time between musicians. One is Joo-won Kim. He's originally from South Korea, where he trained as a classical musician. And he fell in love with hip-hop after moving to the U.S. as an adult. He now leads Ensemble Myknawooj, which brings those seemingly disparate musical styles together. The other artist is Khafre J. He's a rapper, an educator, and executive director of Hip Hop for Change, which uses the music as a tool for education and empowerment. Khafre and Joo-won partnered up to make The Future of Hip Hop, America's Newest Indigenous Art. It's a TED-style conference that highlights local innovators in hip hop dance, music, and visual art, and it's happening this Saturday at Impact Hub in Oakland. Jen Chien spoke with them about misperceptions of hip hop culture and why a conference like this is needed.
Can you describe what this summit is that you guys have planned, The Future of Hip-Hop, America's Newest Indigenous Art?
Yeah, I mean, I think people's perceptions of what hip-hop is, I mean, people are being sold a bill of goods. There's so much nuance to our culture. I mean, we got a homie, Davu Flint, that raps in front of a jazz band on a stool with a harmonica and sings. I know a lady who's a classically trained opera singer and a rapper. You know what I'm saying? Not only if we can show people the diversity in hip-hop and just how capable it is of going into anywhere and taking anything and, you know, making it something totally unexpected, totally new. That's the future of hip-hop. It's working. It's stretching a medium.
So what do you think it is that people misunderstand or don't understand about hip-hop, especially people maybe that don't listen to it or who aren't fans?
I can tell you my version of it, my understanding, because I think that a lot has to do with race, because when jazz was developing, people used to call it hot music, jungle music, and they discredited it. But it's actually one of the most significant musical inventions of 20th century.
For sure.
And hip-hop is the same way. And the invention of rhyming, the way the MCs rhymed with the music, has never been done. So flat out, it would be racism. So.
I think the biggest misperception about hip-hop, and even why, you know, if you go back to the 70s and you know, late 70s, you see the type of artistry with DJs, for example, doing things like beat juggling. And when that whole system becomes co-opted and you use it as entertainment and you're trying to sell massive amounts of units, that nuance, that diversity, it gets lost. You get a homogenization to the lowest common denominator to make sure you can sell the most amount of product. And that lowest common denominator in America, that's sex, drugs, and money. When we get to this mass scale of production of hip-hop, figuring out that, you know, hey, more kids in the suburbs who, you know, aren't from the hood are going to buy hip-hop if it's, like, really stereotypical, and we can get a lot of money. And they don't really care about the artistry as much because they don't have that cultural connection. And the idea is that, hey, hip-hop is about, like prowess and ability to express and eloquate yourself in a way that resonates to your people around you. You know, we have a system right now, 1996 Telecom Act, that three companies own 90% of the platform for my culture, and they make 90% of their money from suburban white people. Now, those people don't know that it is tricking if you got it. Like, Lil Wayne says it ain't, but it is. They still is in the hood, and they still buy Lil Wayne, even though he's saying something that's definitely not of the community hip-hop comes from. And Taco Bell makes a lot of tacos, but no one thinks they're Mexican, you know? But people think that all this hip-hop is my culture, my, you know, my image. So when I walk down the street and I stand out there and say, hey, talk to me about hip-hop, people grab their babies more often than not. You know, and that's because in America, 75% of white people report not having people of color for friends, let alone a hip hop hood black guy like myself. So they're more comfortable with seeing Lil Wayne on TV than ever shaking a hand with somebody like me. And that weighs in every social interaction I'm in. So, yeah. What racism?
I'm speaking with Coffrey J from Hip Hop for Change and Juwon Kim of Ensemble Miknawuj, co-presenters of The Future of Hip Hop, America's Newest Indigenous Art.
So one thing that is interesting for me is that there's a flip side to it, because Ensemble Miknawuj is essentially Uber for artistic organization. What that means is that we realize that all old models of Western European artistic organization, like SF Symphony, like Metropolitan Opera, that are hemorrhaging money right now. And we know that this kind of work that is based on Western European aesthetics that are completely alienating to a lot of people are no longer working. What we're doing is to create something that works right now, that is based on the material that traditionally have been treated with much disrespect. We actually go deeper into the material and then create something that is organic to this culture. So that's the idea. So the idea of disruption.
Yeah, and I think that's what resonated with me the most, because I feel the same way, and it's the same idea, Hip Hop for Change. I mean, we have a system. We have a paradigm that means that if I'm not using the B word in my raps and I'm not basing my narratives on money being the base of my worth, then I don't get paid. My career will die if I'm not excellent at doing a crappy job I don't like and hustling on the side. I think that's the heart of this. You know, we need to have self-determination in our platforms. It's so important to make sure that we control the message of who we are. And if we don't, then we get shot by police at a higher rate. If we don't control that message, then Mexican people are bad for our economy. And Syrian refugees are like the most dangerous people in the world, because I think media representations are killing us.
Those were musicians Juwon Kim and Coffrey J. They spoke with KALW's Jen Sheehan. Hip Hop for Change and Ensemble Miknawuj are co-presenting a TED-style conference called The Future of Hip Hop, America's Newest Indigenous Art. That's at Impact Hub in Oakland this Saturday. Learn more and buy tickets through our website, KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. So maybe that last conversation helped you make plans for Saturday night. Well, here's an idea for Sunday. Saxophonist Chico Freeman is performing at Yoshi's in Oakland. Chico moved to Europe from the States 10 years ago. He started exploring the musical traditions of Eastern Europe and Africa. When he moved back stateside, he incorporated his experiences into a unique and lyrical sound. Producer Reese Ehrlich tells us more in this jazz perspective.
Back in the mid-2000s, saxophonist Chico Freeman moved to Greece and later Switzerland to continue his already prodigious jazz career. He played concert halls and jazz festivals throughout the continent. And like generations of American jazz musicians before, he found a very receptive audience.
I always wondered why Europeans seem to embrace this music so much. And in some cases, I felt even more than it was embraced in the States itself. That was interesting because I found, first of all, that because of their love for classical music and the fact that this is something that's part of their culture, their heads were and ears were more open to, let's say, more complicated or intricate musical ideas and things.
Freeman traveled to Hungary and Spain, where he jammed with gypsy musicians. He later performed with artists from North and Sub-Saharan Africa. He appreciated the different musical cultures, but didn't seek to combine their sound directly with jazz.
For me, it doesn't work like that. It's not like I go hear something and I decide to incorporate it. I was more wanted to absorb it and let it come out in a more natural way rather than to consciously sit down and say, okay, I'm going to play this scale or I'm going to do this or that. I wanted to let it become more of a part of me.
But when Freeman sat down to compose, his explorations had an impact. In this original tune, Dance of Life for Luani, Freeman uses a gypsy-style minor key to create an eerie and compelling melody. After growing up in Chicago and later staying in New York, life in Europe produced culture shock as well. For decades, African-American jazz artists stayed in Europe because they faced relatively less racism. And for Freeman, it took some adjusting.
One of the interesting things when I first came, I heard a siren and the police were looking for someone. And my first reaction was to look around because I'm thinking that they're probably looking for me or someone that looks like me. And what happened was they were totally not interested in me. They were looking for someone else.
Freeman acknowledges there's plenty of racism and xenophobia in Europe towards Arabs, Muslims, and Eastern Europeans. And he followed the news about police killings of African Americans and the growth of anti-police brutality movements in the U.S.
Racism is everywhere, but it feels much less here than it did in the States, even when I was there before I left. And now when I listen to these stories, it feels like it's pretty dangerous for a black man to walk the streets of the States in many, many cities in America.
Despite the continuing turmoil in the U.S., and after 10 years of musical exploration abroad, Freeman decided to return to New York.
I felt like what I wanted to do was incorporate what I've learned and experienced and bring it back home. That's what made me want to come back, really. And also that there's a whole new crop of young players that came up since I've been gone, and what I think are very highly talented players.
I'm Reese Ehrlich with a Jazz Perspective.
Chico Freeman is performing Sunday night at Yoshi's in Oakland. Jazz Perspectives are an occasional series here on Cross Currents. The music you heard in that piece comes from Chico's 2016 CD, Spoken Into Existence. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Almost there. Got it.
And there's actually dog paws down there too, so when we have our dog running, we make her touch those dog paws.
Think you recognize that? To tell you more, we sent KALW's Jordan Winters underneath the Golden Gate Bridge.
At one end of Crissy Field in San Francisco is a small wooden plaque fastened to a chain-link fence. It's nicknamed Hopper's Hands for the pair of brightly painted hand shapes on its surface. For over 15 years, throngs of people have made contact with the plaque. It acts as an informal checkpoint. Runners come from all around the city to give the hands a good slap before turning around to finish their runs. I meet June Karesma, who's on a run with his family. They started from their home in Russian Hill.
Well, ever since we've been running to the Golden Gate Bridge, it's a good halfway point. Mm-hmm. And usually we just, it's kind of like everybody pretty much knows to touch the hands before you return. And then there's actually dog paws down there too. So when we have our dog running, we make her touch those dog paws.
The Kuresmas are just some of the weekend warriors who pass through. Many runners training for the San Francisco Marathon visit this point. The sound of watches clocking personal records are very common. On the flip side, plenty of nonchalant tourists and casual walkers find amusement in this little plaque that acts as an encouraging high five. I chat with Harry and Janet Chapman, who are out on their weekly stroll with their dog.
We're not runners, but I know it's for runners, but still, it's just we take this walk a lot and it's just a tradition.
The Chapman's dog, Dottie, may not have touched the wall, but she still gets credit for making the trip.
Speak, 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 speak.
Though the plaque seems like a lighthearted feature of Crissy Field, the place around it has a more serious side. I spot David Heron standing alone, staring through the fog into the dark greenish water.
Yeah, I also scattered my grandma and grandpa's ashes under the bridge 5 years ago.
Wow.
So I get to come here and say hi to them too.
Alfred Hitchcock must have seen this same mysterious beauty in this spot years ago. He made it the backdrop to one of his most famous scenes in his film, Vertigo. That splash was actress Kim Novak jumping into the freezing bay water from the exact spot Hopper's Hands is today. In the movie, Novak survives, but the Bridge Rail Foundation reports 30 people a year jump from the bridge and do not have the same outcome. I was curious what people knew about the history of this place and about Ken Hopper, the man whose name is inscribed on the plaque.
So, do you know who Hopper is?
And while a few visitors weren't sure,
I'm hoping he was a runner a long time ago.
Most of the locals knew the story well. Here's Harry Chapman again.
Well, it was a bridge worker that noticed that runners couldn't run around the Fort Point any longer after this heightened security. And so he noticed that they would come and then, you know, run back. So put those up, is my understanding.
Ken Hopper was indeed an iron worker on the Golden Gate Bridge for 30 years. He retired, but part of his job was being on the bridge suicide rescue squad. Every night, one member of the squad is on call and ready to rush to the bridge if someone is perched on the ledge. In an interview with Runner's World magazine, Hopper denied that the plaque was a symbol of his work on the squad. For others, the topic of suicide looms over this place, especially for tour guide Sahi Chadley, who comes by here with tourists all the time. Chadley had a friend who attempted suicide off the Golden Gate Bridge.
He made it his life goal to like help people with depression and suicide. So it has a mysterious kind of dark side to it, but then it's really cool that 18 billion cars have traveled across the bridge since it's open. So it's a great thing for commerce and ideas. So I couldn't imagine our skyline without it.
Joy Fan has been running along this path for a few years now, but I was the first one to tell her about Hopper's story.
It just humanizes the you know, traditions of San Francisco. I think so many people, tourists especially, we love to see the city for its beauty, its, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge, its landmarks, but to be able to understand who this guy was, I mean, it'll make me think of the hands in a whole different way.
Stories like Hopper's help remind her that it's important to run in places with some history to them.
What I love is running, because you get to see everything. I mean, if you're in a car, you miss out on people on the streets and what matters to them.
After hearing all these stories, I couldn't resist also participating in the tradition and went out with my friend Alex Campo to enjoy the space and pay our own respects to Kent Hopper.
First one to touch it wins.
Oh, okay.
In San Francisco, I'm Jordan Winters for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Jordan. That's a great story. And a lot of you knew exactly where we recorded this week. Our winner is Brenda Austin. She's been running there for many years. Congratulations, Brenda. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt and maybe you can wear it on your next run. Thanks so much for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks a lot, Julie. So you listening right now, do you have other mysterious sounds you think would make a good audiograph? Give us a call and tell us about it. 415-264-7106. Share your signature sound of the Bay Area at 415-264-7106. That's it for us today. Our team includes Bonnie Chan, Jurgen Klemm, Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. The line producer today was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. And our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. We're listening to the sounds of Atomic Love Bomb. The group is taking part in this weekend's International Pop Overthrown Festival at Hotel Utah in San Francisco. This group's performing Saturday at 7:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.